said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Ursula Costantini, who is an economic affairs officer at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, we call UNCTAD. I'm also proud to say that she is a former senior economist on the staff with INET and did some wonderful work in the years we worked together. She's joined by Richard Colesville Wright, who is director of the Division on Globalization and Development Strategies at UNCTAD as well. And he's worked in the United Nations context in both New York and Geneva. We're here to talk about the horizon and the challenge in the world, but it's very well presented in the Trade and Development Report of 2020 that came out in late September and has some very interesting issues, which I think we can explore today, about things which you might call the fault lines that preceded the pandemic and how the pandemic has changed the course and intensified the challenges before us. Ursula and Richard, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invite.
I think we should just start with your perspective. Obviously, here we are in October of 2020. The pandemic continues. The distress, particularly as it propagates and intensifies towards the developing economies, is at the center of a lot of the work that you all do at UNCTAD. So why don't we talk about what do you see that's happening? What do you see that's changing in light of the pandemic or being unmasked about the realm of ideas in light of this episode? What do you fear is not happening? What would you like to recommend? And what's laudable? Who are you cheering on when you see them out there advocating and trying to change the world? So let's start with Richard. Your thoughts in creating this report and in the, how would I say, what does the situation and the horizon look like to you?
Like everybody else, Rob, we are looking at the world through a glass darkly. There's a level of uncertainty that makes thinking about the issues you raise pretty difficult for anybody. I guess one of the things that motivated us in this report was, you know, the concern that we would, despite all the talk that we were going to recover better, that we were going to do things differently, that this was a never let a crisis go to waste, all that rhetoric, that we would end up repeating the mistakes after the global financial crisis, where the leading economies, after an initial burst of enthusiasm for doing things differently, very much reverted to business as usual. Austerity became the norm of policy adjustment. There was very little effort to re-regulate finance in a systematic way. There was no serious attempt to address underlying inequalities that had been revealed by the financial crisis. And not surprisingly to us, and we talked a lot about this in UNCTAD in previous reports, the recovery from the global financial crisis has been particularly weak, and there's a set of underlying conditions that simply have made the global economy in general particularly vulnerable to shocks, and the position of developing countries more so than others. And so the idea of the report and our concern was to try and outline the reasons why the world economy was already in a particular weak place before COVID-19 hit us, and what kind of alternatives that we would like to see that would genuinely make good on this rhetorical talk of recovering better. And there are certain reasons to be optimistic still, I think, that clearly things have been done that were inconceivable a few years ago. This talk of a return to kind of Keynesian type policies. There's a lot of talk about the need for industrial policy. There's talk about basic income. Modern monetary theory has made a comeback of sorts. So there has been a change of tone in the discussion about policymaking. Yeah, we find ourselves, for example, very close to some of the arguments that the Financial Times, which after all is the newspaper of international big business, talking about the need for taboo-breaking policies, most of which, I guess, in one way or another, revolve around the need to have a much larger role for the state in dealing with accumulation of problems, both in developed and developing countries, and that's certainly a position that we feel comfortable with. I guess, for us, the concern in particular is that developing countries are not in a position to do this by themselves, and the difference in terms of the policy packages that have been put together in response to the crisis, again, has highlighted the difference between developed and developing countries. And developing countries therefore need international support and an appropriate multilateral system that can give them that support. And the honest truth is that the multilateral system, as it's currently constituted, is not fit for purpose in terms of providing the necessary support for developing countries. We believe that was true coming out of the last crisis, and we certainly believe it's true coming out of the shock as a result of COVID-19. So, reasons for optimism around rethinking the role of the state, rethinking the balance between the public and the private sectors, but a real concern about the limits of international coordination and provision of global public goods, which we don't really see as being in place to deal with this kind of shock.
Well, let's talk within countries a little bit before we talk about the international dimension of collaboration. Ursula, in the realm of fiscal policy, you've worked in the United States for a few years, and what I'm seeing is, at one level, people are saying a bigger role for the state, as Richard suggested, would be very, very positive. At another level, they say the state is captured and it's providing subsidies to plutocrats and large corporations. How can we use fiscal policy in the context of broader, which you might call democratic representation, in the design of those policies when people are so skeptical about the nature of governance in this country and in other places around the world?
Well, thanks. Thanks for the question. How can we do that? Well, it takes an effort that is not... that cannot be done only in one country. That's at this point pretty clear. And I think that if the pandemic, in a way, changed our plans, because we were, trying to talk about and discuss about Green New Deal, how to effectively design that. The fact that the pandemic arrived had to change our plans, had to change the fact that we needed to actually address those pressing issues in, also in our report. So in that sense, it was a disturbance from a progress that we were making and that others, especially in the past years, were making in that direction. But it also created a sort of interruption, something that gave an opportunity for our ideas to be more heard. And that is because, in a sense, what came out very quickly, I think, at least, is that the idea that you can use fiscal policy just to temporarily manage the cycle, so with temporary and timely interventions, has proven to be a failure. And it really took a global pandemic to show that actually the resilience depends on the fact that we build permanent structures, that we build welfare and healthcare facilities, and we also, in many cases, when there's a balance of payment constraint, we do industrial policy, something that takes time, and you cannot just activate at the time of a crisis. And this has become also incredibly, incredibly obvious, I think, in the U.S. in the context of the healthcare. The fact that you know, if you do have a structure that is already established and able to effectively, efficiently care for everyone for free, you save a lot of time, a lot of lives, and a lot of money when a crisis like this one comes out. So, and I'm saying this connected to what you were talking about in terms of democracy, because when you do have these permanent structures in place, there are less situations of emergencies that come out. And you do also have a situation in which fiscal provisions, fiscal decisions can be discussed without the idea that there is no other alternative but to do this very quickly. So to give subsidies to the too big to fail banks, for example. So the fracture in the discourse that we were building that this pandemic created, in a sense, is hopefully functional for us to spread the idea that if you use fiscal policy in a different way, in a way that is that creates more equality, and rather than just smooth the cycle, if you even can do that, that has also spillovers in terms of the capacity to for the population to control the use of funds going forward. I don't know if that makes makes sense and answers your question. I think that one the central banks have really come out as the main actor in this situation, and already it was the case in the global financial crisis and afterwards. And here again, we see that they are the only actors and policy institutions that can act very quickly, but and of course, this has had the advantage of making essentially a laughing stock of the idea that central banks should not, cannot monetize debt, cannot do expansionary policies with or there would be inflation. But at the same time, it has done so in a way that also hasn't really allowed us to address collectively the consequences of this monetization, of this monetary policy, which is in effect, as you say, is subsidizing a financial system that is fundamentally predatory or parasitic, really. And I don't see this lightly, and parasitic in the sense that it makes a creditor feel like they don't have to care about the resilience and the health of the debtor. So there, it creates, essentially squeezes the room for solidarity among countries, between creditors and debtors, and so on.
What they call the mother of all moral hazards, the blank check. I remember the late Paul Volcker, who I knew quite well, was very, very concerned. You know, you had mentioned about central banks somehow are in a place where they have the legitimacy to act. But a lot of people are very critical right now that the way they have acted, they're glad they have acted, but the distributional elements of it. And Volcker used to be very concerned that, as he put it, when people on the right, like Ron Paul and others, criticize the Fed, they say it's independent of what? Independent from whom? And he said this independence is going to be very, very fragile when it looks like they bail out banks for their toxic, in those days, mortgage derivatives, and yet they say no to buying municipal bonds that would allow school systems, health systems, infrastructure, and law enforcement to be supported during a downturn that was caused by the failure of the banking system. And so I look now, and Dennis Kelleher from Better Markets, who I had on as a guest a couple of weeks ago, he said, well, you know, we got a real problem here, because it's almost like you've got a lender of last resort for the powerful, and yet we don't have something for the people, an economic security agency or something of that sort. Pavlina Chernova has also said to me in a podcast that what we're doing is we're protecting assets, not people. So I think there's a great deal of, controversy right around the surface. But the need for government action and collective action is one thing. And I think your report makes very good case for that. How it is constructed in the nature of governance and what governance is independent of is another type of challenge. Richard,
just on that point.
Yeah, please.
It is interesting. I think that one of the last vestiges of kind of hardcore neoliberalism has been this idea of the independence of central banks, and that certainly it was coming into question, I think, before the pandemic, around the notion of climate change and the need to make large-scale public investments to be able to address the challenges around climate mitigation and adaptation. And you had people like Mark Carney who were clearly raising issues about what they call the tragedy of the horizons and the need for central banks to behave, arguably with a wider mandate than the kind of inflation targeting that had become the norm over the previous two or three decades. Yeah, I think the pandemic is accelerating that discussion. That seems to be, there are more people are asking the question that you've just asked, independent of what, supportive of whom. I think that's become a much more prominent part of the policy discussion than I think would have been the case if we hadn't had to deal with this tragic shock that we are all facing.
I think that would be nice if independence meant really, in a sense, neutrality, or meaning letting countries and governments and communities decide what to do with the policy and fiscal space central banks allow them to have.
Mm-hmm. I think this is very interesting. We've all been exposed to the notion of modern monetary theory. And going back, as Richard mentioned at the outset, the great financial crisis, we were accustomed to financiers acting as disciplinarians. We can't afford it. We can't afford it. They had a view of, the importance of fiscal austerity and debt sustainability and so forth. And then when they made a mess of things, they snapped their fingers and say, hey, guys, give me $800 billion right now. That's just in the United States. And so then you get to the place where we're selectively invoking scarcity. And then, as you mentioned, people like Mark Carney start to say, well, wait a minute. And this is not his words. These are mine. Would I like to have 2% inflation up to the time in 15 years when we extinguish life on Earth? Or could I tolerate 4% inflation and finance a Green New Deal? The trade-offs are obvious. But we're having to break out of that mode of what you might call the deification of price stability at the expense of everything else. And the pandemic, I think, has reinforced the what you might call elasticity of supply of financing when the situation warrants or demands. But how do you see, Richard, now we're faced with what I'll call the recent use of fiscal capacity for the pandemic, climate change on the horizon, an unmasking that our system has been inadequate, but are you seeing people as exhausted and wary of using fiscal policy, and therefore the climate agenda will be less likely to be achieved? Or do you see it more like a call to action and an example that, how do you say, catalyzes a stronger and more rapid response to climate change?
Look, our concern, and it's still our concern, is that we could see it go either way, right? I mean, we're already hearing noises from you know, the inflation hawks and the kind of the deficit hyenas, you know, that this can't go on, that we have to, you know, the government cannot behave in this way indefinitely, that the fiscal prudence and proper household budgetary management will need to come back sooner or later. At the same time that people are asking the question, well, if we can do this to save corporations as well as banks this time around, you know, why can't we use these same techniques to deliver on a more progressive and sustainable agenda? So I think, I mean, but these ultimately are political questions, I think, rather than simply economic questions. So it gets you into the issue of the politics of recovery as much as the techniques of recovery. And I guess in that sense, we have begun in recent work in UNCTAD to talk about, to pick up this language of a Green New Deal, which we are very supportive of, but always to make the point, which is incredibly important to our constituency, that the kind of expansion and interventions that we think are required to be able to combine a just transition with a serious tackling of the climate challenge, particularly, but not only that, other environmental challenges too, that we need to have a global Green New Deal. That is, there needs to be, going back to my earlier point, that you know, developing countries who at the moment are on the front line of the climate crisis, you know, they will need significant financial support from the international community. And despite all the talk that we've heard from and the actions to some extent, although we don't think they've been adequate, but some of the actions by the IMF and the G20 in response to the COVID shock. Despite the fact that the IMF and certainly some of its researchers have you know, made some significant changes from a decade ago, they've become much more supportive of a role for public investment. They've readjusted their multipliers to show the positive impact of a sustainable public investment drive. They've been much more concerned with inequality, I think, than was true of people in the fund a decade ago. Despite that fact, when you look at the kinds of policies that are still attached to their lending programs, they tend to have a strong austerity bent. So, you know, we seem to be looking at a moment that could go either way. And for us, talking about a global Green New Deal both allows us to focus on what Ursula was talking about, you know, how we mobilize and spend these resources in a way that is different from the past, but also the way in which we can rejig the multilateral institutions, both finance and monetary and trade in a way that can genuinely support developing countries to come out of this crisis in a stronger and more resilient fashion, and in a way that does not exacerbate the already threatening climate crisis that we're all aware of. So I think this, and that's got us into some trouble with some of our constituencies. The New Deal, you know, is often seen as a very American way of framing the kind of challenges that we're talking about. American scholars have themselves pointed out, there were serious weaknesses with the original New Deal when it came both to internal politics. The question of race has been raised in the context of the limits of the original New Deal, and that's obviously a very topical issue today. And also the way in which the New Deal eventually was extended through the multilateral institutions never really fully embraced the particular challenges that developing countries were facing in the 1950s and 60s as they gained their political independence. But I think for us, at least, it provides a very useful narrative for thinking about how we combine questions of inequality within and across countries and meeting this kind of existential threat from a changing climate and a deteriorating environment more generally.
I think what I see now, moving a little bit to international collaboration coordination, we're seeing a lot of stress about the, which you might call, unbridled value of globalization. We're seeing a lot of stress in the U.S.-China relationship that may have to do with scapegoating in relation to the former notion. But one of the things that I find quite daunting is that you look at climate change, and it's the transformation of energy to go to a zero carbon is a global public good. But you look at countries, say, like India, very large population, dealing with disease, dealing with the essential economic development, and being asked to bear the burden of energy transformation with their own finances is very stressful at a time when so many other things are beckoning for the use of their limited resources. But so it almost seems as if, because if India transforms its energy system, the rest of the world benefits, the rest of the world ought to join in and pay for that transformation. But as I mentioned at the start of this question, that collaborative system seems to be in a lot of tension. How are we going to get over the horizon here and meet this challenge?
That's a big question, Rob. One thing I would seriously say, I think, you know, we would hope that the American administration, whichever form it takes after next week, kind of rediscovers some of its original New Deal roots. I mean, we chose the use of the New Deal because, when we look at what people like Roosevelt himself, but Morgenthau and others were trying to do back in 1944, 1945. I mean, there was a genuine recognition that we were moving into an interdependent world, and that it was to the advantage of the richer countries that they helped the poorer countries to develop, and in the process providing new investment opportunities, new markets, etc., as well as underpinning a more peaceful world. So, I mean, that combination, which I think was incredibly important in the original New Deal, of appreciating the interdependence of the world at the same time that you were pushing for economic and social justice, I think that combination needs to be rediscovered by American policymakers, not only at the domestic level, but in particular at the international level. So you know that that rediscovering of the best of American foreign policy, I think, would be something that we would hope to see as a necessary part of a creating a more sustainable and resilient future. China's challenges are a little bit different. Its rise to being, it's not a hegemon. It's nowhere near competing with the United States as a hegemon. It still has many of the features of a developing country. But you know, its growth and transformation over the last two or three decades is quite remarkable, to the point where it has become a creditor economy, where its currency is internationally recognized, etc. And I guess there is a, you know, its economic rise has probably been in advance of its kind of political economy or ideological position in the global economy. I think China is very much in a learning phase in that context, and clearly the current levels of hostility towards China are not going to be very helpful. Indeed, may force it into a much more insular position that I think would be detrimental both to China and to the world economy. So I think the onus is on the advanced economies to do things differently. But China is also, the greater responsibility is undoubtedly going to fall on China in terms of its own international position and action. So it's this, you know, watching that dynamic is going to be critical to being able to address the kinds of problems that we've been talking about. That's for sure. And there's still a lot of uncertainty, I think, surrounding those dynamics, unfortunately.
Ursula, do you have further thoughts in this realm?
Let me say that, just to make the example, some examples, and go back to some of the themes of the report. Most of the current plea that we hear now to not to end austerity too soon are, I think, really the measure of the irrelevance of a lot of a large part of the multilateral system right now. And this is because when most of these peers say essentially that that countries should keep spending if they can and as long as they can. And so in reality, what they are saying is that they are letting the markets decide the timing of the and the size and the timing of the fiscal effort and the size of the policy space of this country. So they are essentially saying that even though that would be the wrong thing to do, the country should just allow markets to dictate a return to austerity, even if that is a market failure. So the message is even clearer now than it was before, because if they had a theoretical justification for saying that austerity was good, right now there is no theoretical justification that's brought forward. They only say that markets rule, in essence, and they rule even when they're wrong. And I guess that we need all to take notes and of that. And countries are taking notes of that, because they are not spending to the extent even that they could do it now, or they are not taking advantage of the relief that's being offered. For example, only barely more than half of the countries that are allowed to obtain the debt repayment relief, for example, offered by the G20 and the Paris Club, actually accessed that. So I think that, yeah, we are talking about countries, but we are also talking of an overarching system that's really, as I was saying before, predatory more than anything else. So it's beyond the single country to some extent. What's really also, what I think has also some political consequences in terms of the reaction that we could build against this is that half-baked progressive stances like this crowd out more radical proposals to transform things.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that Rob, that surprises us, I guess, when we look at it from a historical point of view, you know, if you take in terms of support from advanced economies to developing countries, you know, you take the Marshall Plan as a kind of classic manifestation of that New Deal thinking. You know, I mean, this. I think the figure is something like 1% of U.S. GDP was channeled to Western Europe over the period 48 to 52, 53. And most of it in the form, as we know, of grants, rather, although there were some there was some lending involved too, but a large chunk of that was in the form of grants. And you compare that with the miserly effort of the G20 under its debt service suspension initiative, which I think, you know, we still haven't got the numbers in, but we're talking about something like $5 billion or $6 billion that is distributed amongst 70-odd developing countries. I mean, the contrast between the kind of the generosity and ambition of the Marshall Plan and that kind of initiative that we've seen in response to this unbelievably dramatic shock from COVID-19 is a very, very stark one, I think.
Your organization sheds a very, very strong light on what's happening in the developing world. And yet much of the news that we read is about the, how do I say, ebbs and flows of the epidemic in the advanced countries. And obviously those countries have been a great source of global aggregate demand. But I'm curious, what do you see as the unique impact on the developing world of the pandemic, and what kind of response does it inspire? How has the pandemic manifest in the developing world in ways that might be different, or given their economic structure in ways in which they must respond differently in light of what's unfolded?
I mean, one of the most obvious, it's an obvious difference, but in a way we're seeing changes in the advanced world that may make it less obvious. But you know, the level of informality in the developing world, even in middle income developing countries, is on a scale that we don't see in the advanced economies, even though we have seen this shift towards a gig economy. And even, you know, economists, people like Peter Temin, for example, who's written for INET, have used the kind of dualistic economy models that were previously used to understand developing country dynamics to understand some of the changing dynamics in the advanced economies. But despite that, you know, the level of informality in the developing world adds a different layer, a different dimension to the kind of challenge that they face from facing this kind of shock, and the ability to respond is all the more difficult as a consequence. Both in terms of responding to the health side of it, you can't really social distance, for example, in many developing countries. It's not an option that is available, but also the ability to mobilize resources on a scale and quickly that is needed is also much more of a challenge when large parts of your workforce are operating informally. So that's a very stark difference between advanced and developing countries. And I mean, of course, the other thing, and it's become much more apparent over the course of the last couple of decades in developing countries, is the way in which they've become so vulnerable to changes in financial sentiment in advanced economies. They've become themselves much heavier borrowers on international capital markets, including through shadow banking arrangements and not just through more traditional markets. And that's added a new layer of vulnerability to many developing countries. And we saw very quickly, as sentiment changed back in March, immediately after the pandemic began to become an obvious problem, the way in which financial markets operated, responded, the huge outflows of capital from emerging economies, and the way in that triggered a very vicious cycle in those countries as pressure was put on currencies, as export earnings declined, commodity prices declined, export earnings declined, you got this very vicious circle taking hold of many developing countries even before the health pandemic itself began to hit them. So the first shocks in many developing countries were not really on the health front, but they were very much on the economic front. And that's in the context of countries that had already acquired very large amounts of debt over the previous decade. Again, you know, itself a reflection not so much of what they were doing, but of the search for higher yields by investors in the advanced economies, given the low levels of the low yields that were available to them domestically. All those kinds of vulnerabilities, I think, have become particularly apparent in response to the COVID-19 shock, and as Ursula said before, the inability of the financial system that was set up really to deal with that kind of situation, the failure of the institutions to provide the necessary cover and support, I think, has been very truly revealed over the course of the last 6 to 8 months.
I know myself, I have followed very closely one of our former colleagues, Martin Guzman, is economy and finance minister in Argentina. And I'm wondering now if one of the, illuminated new institutional frameworks, or more invigorated framework, has to be something related to sovereign debt restructuring. It is very hard for anyone to say that an emerging country by itself caused this decline, which you might call into insolvency, because the pandemic is something that's in many ways beyond anyone's control. And so I wonder, are you, in your report and in your other work, are you exploring a multilateral mechanism for the restructuring and rescheduling of sovereign debt, and how the, which you might call, just burden of adjustment would be shared?
Well, that's an old UNCTAD call, Rob. I mean, long before the IMF talked about the need for a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism back in the 1980s in response to the Latin American debt crisis, UNCTAD was calling for some extension of bankruptcy rules, you know, Chapter 9, Chapter 11, whatever you want to take from the U.S. Context, needed to be extended to the international realm. That you know, it's a long-standing call of UNCTAD to and I think it's an obvious missing piece in the Bretton Woods architecture, even though debt problems were you know, paramount in the 1920s and 1930s and a major source of instability, economic and ultimately political stability in the interwar periods. The Bretton Woods institutions themselves never were able to come up with an institutional mechanism to deal with sovereign debt problems. And it was only when developing countries faced those shocks in the 80s that discussion began to develop in a more systematic way, and certainly that's that UNCTAD was, I think, ahead of the game in that discussion, and I think we have maintained that throughout the course of the last three or four decades that we genuinely do need some sort of multilateral rules and institutions that can handle sovereign debt restructuring in a way that is different from, I mean, and we do work with Martin Guzman, actually, and I think Martin and Joe Stiglitz and other people have long maintained that, you know, the current structure, you know, it's always too little too late in terms of responding to this, the kinds of debt problems that many developing countries face, and that the only way to really bring about a sound resolution is through a transparent multilateral process. And certainly we are working again in response to, and many developing countries have been reluctant to go that way, because in a world that's dominated by footloose capital, they fear that this kind of talk will, in one way or another, make their entry into international markets more problematic. And so they've often steered clear of talk about multilateral solutions to their debt problems. I think, given the scale of the problem that many of them face, and middle income, higher income, lower income developing countries are facing those problems now, that I think there's a growing awareness that some sort of multilateral response is needed, and just simply strengthening bond contracts through collective action clauses, or talking about more transparency in debt negotiations, is not sufficient to deal with the kind of scale of the problem that we're talking about. We are in the process of trying to think through what some kind of global debt authority might look like from a legalistic point of view. And I think that discussion is coming to the fore once again.
Ursula, do you want to add to that, please?
Yeah, I think that there's a fundamental problem how debt sustainability is defined. It's defined also in international organizations and in the very arena where these debt negotiations are done. And I think that the case of Argentina, but also if you look at the budget, Brazil in the last five years, it's pretty evident that you had a positive fiscal stance because they were cutting expenditures, and they were doing that because IMF told them to do so, for example, and that created a budget deficit because revenues were falling faster than expenditures relative to GDP. And even now we see that Latin America is the region that is the most hit by the pandemic in economic terms, and Brazil shows that there's an 8% over GDP discretionary fiscal effort that's close to European levels, for example, the fiscal discretionary effort, but the GDP is falling much, much more. So we are, we constantly misread the meaning of fiscal stance in these countries where government revenue are very, very dependent on the level of spending of the government. And so what we do in the report, we go through all these different determinants, drivers of the growth of the debt to GDP. And we really show that, you know, history shows that austerity for sure is not the way to deal with this. And in many cases, debt to GDP, even during a restructuring, should be allowed to increase, because that would imply a following decrease of the debt to GDP that's faster than in the other case. So it's really the framework by which we understand what's sustainable, what's not, and how to make something sustainable that has to change. And I think that exactly the government of Argentina and Martin Guzman are very aware of that.
We're in a place now where the, which you might call the, on the horizon, the need for a profound Green New Deal, an energy transformation agenda that's world global, is essential. And we're in a place where deficiency of aggregate demand in the aftermath of the pandemic appears to be part of the challenge. It's hard for me to see not doing that, but what resistance has to be overcome here to initiate what you might say the vision? What I really liked about reading the UNCTAD report is it was very bold and clear about what needs to be done. Some of what I've been asking you today is not that it needs to be done or why it needs to be done, but how do we get it done? And I think that, how would I say, you've made a great contribution by providing the vision of the destination and the reasons why. But how are we going to bring planet Earth to the table to actualize what it is that you guys have created?
That's a difficult question, Rob. I think what we tried to show is, I think what we've tried to show, and I think to some extent successfully, is that precisely by addressing some of the underlying conditions, the problem of unregulated finance, footloose capital, the extent of inequality, we provide precisely a kind of environment that can generate a more productive level of investment, whether that's in the public or the private sector, that is required to be able to simultaneously address the climate challenge. I think in that sense, we want to try and show that issues around economic justice, sustainable growth, and a healthy planet are not inconsistent with each other, but they can be mutually supportive. We've had 40 years at least of hyper-globalization in which vested interests have built up over those four decades and will be reluctant to move in a different... I mean, the winners from hyper-globalization are not going to roll over and put their legs in the air in response to the kind of arguments that we've been advancing. So ultimately, the challenges will be political, and I guess that's one reason that, as you began, the one reason people are looking very carefully and closely at what will happen next week in the U.S. election. And it's interesting that a character like Biden has been very reluctant to embrace the language of a Green New Deal, although many of his proposals seem to be in that direction, and that's true also to some extent of the European case for what they call a Green Deal, which again is something we welcome, but we don't think is sufficient. But you've seen more ambitious programs emerging at the country level. The South Koreans have made the Green New Deal a central part of their policy agenda, and we're seeing similar things in developing countries where, again, the desire to combine economic justice with environmental repair they seem to be much more prevalent in the political narrative than they certainly were a decade ago. I guess the frustration for us is that if you talk about a Green New Deal or a global Green New Deal, you do need this international narrative, much as we did in the 1970s around the idea of a new international economic order. I don't think the international sphere, despite all the talk, has really embraced the scale of the challenge that needs to be tackled, and that's And that's a source of frustration. But I certainly see significant changes. I just think that we need to be cognizant, just like Roosevelt was very cognizant in the original New Deal, that he would have to tackle vested interests and provide some sort of countervailing power to those interests, as he did, I think, to some extent successfully. I think people who advocate for the kinds of policies that we are advocating have to be honest that, you know, there will be vested interests that will be fighting very hard against them, and the kinds of political narratives we therefore need to be able to counter that, I think, are going to be incredibly important if we're going to be successful in meeting both these the environmental challenge and the addressing the economic inequities that have become part of the landscape of both developed and developing countries over four decades. I think the pandemic has in a way shown that. I was involved in some of the discussions around Copenhagen at the Copenhagen COP back in 2009, and the only constraint that people talked about was the financial constraint, that the, you know, the kind of investment drive that was needed to deliver on the climate agenda was just too ambitious from a financing point of view. Interestingly enough, I think that is no longer the sticking point of ideas around a Green New Deal. I think it's the politics now of a Green New Deal that has become the real center of the challenge, and I think that's a positive thing. I think that's a positive development.
Well, I see, Ursula, just let me, I see one of the things that you're bringing into focus,
but, you know,
with your focus, sorry, on the emerging world is how many of the human lives on Earth sit in the balance with what we decide to do, with what has been what you might call a very narrow power structure making those decisions, or the vested interests that have prevailed. And I think that this report is really quite an eye-opener, an awakening for people to understand the breadth of the consequences of not responding in the ways that you describe. Ursula, I'm sorry, I stepped a little bit on your words. Please, I welcome your thoughts.
Yeah, no, that's you're quite right. I actually joined UNCTAD in March of this year, so I sort of started living the crisis the moment I arrived there. So there was some natural degree of enthusiasm in me, regardless. But I also joined this organization where there's a lot of great economists that were right there in the rooms where so many times things went the wrong way, So there's a sort of, it's in the bones of this organization, the fact that there has to be some degree of rational pessimism and also alertness to how things might go wrong. And still, yet at the same time, there's the energy to keep saying, to be constructive. And I think that what we'll see, as you say, we cannot expect the king, even if it's naked, to really be shameful and change policies. But it's from the bottom up that this change needs to come. And after this is over, which has been really something that has repressed us a lot, it kept us home. It created lots of financial pressure on many households. After this is over, I think there will be a natural societal uprising, a sort of explosion of what had been repressed over these months. And a narrative that's constructive and positive has to be ready for that in order to catalyze, I think, what the energy that has been repressed so far. And I think that our work can be there to contribute at least to that outcome. And I expect that, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, people said, oh, it's going to change everything. It's going to change how we move, etc. And then we had the end of the first wave in Europe, the beginning of the slow restart in the summer, and really nothing changed. People just, you know, went back to do what they were doing before. So there was no real reorganization of the of cities, of transportation, and so on. And now we are in a second wave, and we are back where we were before. So it's even more frustrating than the first time. So I think that people are really frustrated, but also waiting for the time when they can go out again and talk to each other and also demonstrate.
And I think, Rob, that, you know, one of the things that has been quite shocking, I think, in the crisis is, I mean, the contrast between, and particularly in the United States, the contrast between, you know, real big winners from COVID-19. I mean, we've seen that in the increase in the portfolio of a handful of billionaires, contrasting with the, you know, the what happened in the US and this failure to extend the CARES Act to a new round of support for households and the threat of people being evicted, you know, as it's difficult for them to pay rents, the fear of healthcare bills that could escalate. I mean, I think that, you know, there's been a dramatic contrast there I think, you know, provides pause for thought for many people, and I think that's true across the advanced world. And I personally believe it does depend on whether, you know, whether the state can channel those sentiments into a genuine progressive agenda that can simultaneously address those frustrations and anxieties as it addresses this existential threat from a changing climate and related environmental degradation. I think that's, you know, that's where the politics will play itself out.
Yeah. Well, I'll cite our research director, Tom Ferguson, who's been a mentor to both my career and recently to Ursula. And he said, I think many people are cynical because they think that the bailout was done for the donors, not for the citizens in the United States. And the distributional implications were, as you just cited, quite demoralizing, and particularly in the latest round with the impasse as we approach the presidential election. But anyway, I think we should probably draw things to a conclusion. If either of you have final thoughts, I would welcome them now, but I want to thank you. I thank you, Ursula, for the work you've done with INET, for the summer school that you've run at UNCTAD in conjunction with INET, and for, most importantly, for the beautiful and illuminating challenge that you raise and give voice to the need for the well-being of so many people who live on Earth and who are struggling in the context of the pandemic. Final thoughts from either?
Thank you.
I'm not really right. I'd like to thank you and INET for allowing us to poach Ursula, first of all. That's very, very generous of you. I guess the only one is that it's very easy to be pessimistic given the things that we've talked about. But I do think there are genuine opportunities for a more progressive agenda emerging. I think our small attempt to provide at least a consistent narrative around that is one of those. But we ourselves are finding new alliances that we haven't necessarily explored in the past through UNCTAD with civil society. An interesting one with the Vatican, for example. The Pope as a moral authority on these issues, you know, has become a very important voice in this search for a different kind of model. Labor unions are moving towards how they can embrace both their own traditional challenges as well as combining that with both development challenges and environmental challenges. So I mean, it is easy to be pessimistic, but I do think there are changes afoot that need to be exploited, but do offer genuine hope going forward.
I agree with you about all that you said and about the Pope, but I want to emphasize the Pope's latest encyclical is quite powerful, quite challenging. But I do want to emphasize that you yourselves, both with our audience today, in your reports and in all of your work, are a beacon that nourishes that hope. And it's high time. It's absolutely essential that people doing work like the two of you do raise your voice at this moment. Thanks for being with me.
So are you?
I'm sorry.
So are you, Rob?
Well, we try. I get nourishment every day from being online with people just like the two of you, and hopefully we can impart that to a broader community. We have a Young Scholars convening coming up between the 6th and 15th of November. That's a worldwide virtual conference. And hopefully we can, bring the momentum even more powerfully, more broadly through episodes like that. Thank you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for the opportunity, Rob. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.